they provide shade, oxygen, and increase the value of your home. So save the trees we have and plant more.
And you are listening to radio station WUSB in Stony Brook. It's 6 o'clock, time for another edition of Off the Wall.
Management, like corporate wait, speak.
Kyle, on here.
Oh, we are.
Good evening. It's another edition of Off the Wall. Emmanuel here. Joined tonight by Kyle.
Yes.
And you might as well finish the point because we were engaged in a conversation when the music faded down.
I was talking about the lack of competency in a lot of our peer groups and volunteers.
Okay, and I'm just bringing up the point. If you want to have competency, competence is the word to use. The competency is not even a word, I don't think.
Okay. But there's a plural. It's competencies.
How do you pluralize competence? Like, you have many competences?
After the C, it's I-E-S, right? Competencies.
You have many skills? You have many...
But is competency with a Y, is that a real word?
I don't think it is.
Because I used it, and I'm. It sounds like I'm wrong.
Well, it does sound that way. When you know, it's a word that you could use, but what I'm saying is I don't think it's necessary because competence already has the same meaning as what you're saying with competency. Wasting a syllable.
So where I'm incorrect is that you would measure someone's competence. You wouldn't measure someone's competency.
Yeah.
When you say that, it sounds kind of wrong.
Because what's the difference?
There is no difference.
Now I'm going to look it up.
Competency.
You're forcing me to look it up, and I really didn't want to have to do this.
It is kind of adding another syllable. It might be just a funny thing that I convinced myself I was right linguistically, and it's always been wrong. I know people can relate with that. But I know competencies, plural, is a thing.
Okay, so when I type in competency, I get competence.
Okay, fine.
But then it says noun competency, and your word is right there.
Really? With a Y?
Yeah, with a Y.
What does it mean?
All right, I'm asking Merriam-Webster. definition of competency. Competence, such as possession of sufficient knowledge or skill. A specific area of competence. Oh, there's your plural there.
Yeah.
But it doesn't explain the singular.
Like, does our president exhibit competency?
No, but I do think he exhibits competence. See, what's the difference? It's the same word.
Incontinence?
No.
Well, I don't want to know.
You're veering into a topic nobody wants to discuss.
Okay.
What a day we've had. Oh, my God. We just got here.
We did things.
I thought it would be nice to get a few things done. And it turns out, sometimes you like to get things checked, you know, like blood pressure and cholesterol levels and things like that. And it turns out you can do that in certain drugstores. I thought it'd be fun to do that in a particular drugstore, but it turns out there's only one. It's on the South Shore, and you had to make an appointment. But then after I made the appointment, I saw that for a cholesterol check, you don't have to make an appointment. You can just walk right in. So we drove down, then walked right in. Then that's when they told us about the lunch break they take. That's not on the website.
And it was still like 2 hours away?
No, it was a quarter to two.
And they would be back at 3.
And the lunch break is from 2 to 3.
Right.
And they were closed because of the lunch break, which was 15 minutes away, and they hadn't told us about. And, you know, meanwhile, here I am without my piece of paper saying I could just walk in and get this test done. And then the pharmacist, doctor, I'm not exactly sure what she was.
Registered nurse?
She came out and said, yeah, since appointments take 20 minutes, we close 15 minutes before we close. Something like that. Keep in mind, for this test, we have to fast for 12 hours. So we were in a bad mood already. And you explained that to her.
Well, I wasn't very tactful in the way I said it.
No, but that was the beauty of it.
I came off a little gruff, but the first thing that came to mind, because she's sitting here giving us song and dance about her lunch break, and then she's telling us, oh yeah, by the way, you need to fast for 12 hours. I just retorted to her, yeah, we know that we have to fast. That's why we're not very pleasant right now.
And she's talking to us about a lunch break, you know?
It's like,
we're starving.
Yeah.
The only thing we could have is water.
Yeah.
And we just want to get this thing done. So she's telling us, yeah, you won't be seen till evening if you walk in because we're full. So at that point, I was happy I made the appointment before I realized that you could just walk in, because just walking in apparently means walk in and stay a long time before you leave.
Well, also, you could shed light on the whole kiosk fiasco. Their kiosk has you check in, and that crashed, of course.
Oh, my God. Yeah, we walked up to this nice little computer thing, entered all the information, and then it was spinning a circle. I'm not sure what OS it was. It was not Windows.
I think it was Linux.
Linux,
and
wow.
And it was also saying you have 1 minute or something.
No, it was saying the session will end because of no activity. And I'm trying. There's no buttons to hit.
The
thing is
submitting.
Spinning.
Yeah, it's submitting. The wheel is spinning. It's supposed to be doing stuff. You can't attend it at that point, and yet it's telling you it's unattended.
So, so that basically elevates your blood pressure for when they check that. I guess maybe that's part of it.
Well, this is all more fun and quote easier than going through the rigmarole of a physician visit and so on. but
which would have taken a fraction of the time.
All the mechanisms and schedules and absurdities of this particular way of doing it just lent to its own sort of chaos.
And we're not going to tell you what drugstore it's in, but we will tell you the name of the place is Minute Clinic. Minute Clinic. It was not a minute.
Yeah, it took
half
a day.
It was not an hour. It was all day.
Yeah, half a day, all day.
Healthcare.
I think at one point the nurse practitioner said we should have come in the morning.
Yeah, well, they don't tell you that on the webpage either.
For walk-in, of course, yeah.
Wow. So this was really an adventure.
Yeah, well, and this is, in practice, the evidence of a market-based solution. And the market can make a market, but it's not always very efficient and can be annoying in and of itself.
I just actually, the appointment was really good when we finally got in. Because a couple other people didn't show up, so we got their slot. We were able to sort of leapfrog ahead. But I realized I told them that we do a radio show. That's why we had to make sure we left at a certain time, so they could be listening now. So if you are listening, it's a great service. We enjoyed it. Well, as much as you enjoy being stabbed by a needle. Yeah, it's just a little bit frustrating sometimes because there's so few of them. If there were more of them, then it would be less frustrating. There, how about that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to talk about parent hospitals and if they are direct competitors with Stony Brook, but let's not get into that.
No, I don't need to compete over healthcare. Right,
for what? A snarky aside. Let's mm-hmm. just change the subject.
I almost got run off the road by a cop. That was fun.
Yeah, sheriff.
Wow. Yeah, sheriff's deputy car.
That was number 420.
Okay, I wasn't going to say the actual number, but as long as you did, yeah, maybe he took that number a little too seriously.
He was late to hell.
No, I was on the Sunrise Highway. I sound like I'm from out of town, the Sunrise Highway. I was on Sunrise Highway, and, you know, I look in that mirror, and there's this guy coming up on me, like, really fast, and he's about to hit me. I had to swerve out of his way. And then after I swerved, I realized I was a cop. It wasn't of his lights on or anything. Just was driving like a maniac. Oh, my God.
They roll up behind people and basically expect them to part ways like Moses, you know, part the sea of traffic. And they do that with the same urgency as though they were going to an emergency. But, of course, he doesn't have any rationale. He's just driving like you-know-what.
Look.
And exerting that same, quote, authority. And I don't know. It doesn't engender nice thoughts towards police officers.
No, well, it's not so much – I mean, the fact that it was a cop. Maybe it was a stolen cop car. You know, I should have maybe said – possibly cops – one of your cars got stolen because that's not how cops are supposed to drive. But and I can't verify the number. You're saying the number. I'm not verifying the number. That's your opinion.
Well, that's just one that came to mind.
Yeah. I mean, you can't report these things. Who do you call? You call the cops and say, hey, there's a cop driving like a crazy person?
Yeah, then the police benevolent union comes and knocks down your mailbox or something.
No, I actually did that once in New York City because by Tompkins Square Park, I saw a cop almost run over a bicyclist and just speed through a red light. I called it in and reported it. And like 2 a.m, I'm getting prank calls that I never got before. And I know it was a cop because this guy who sounded drunk said, you call the police. I was like, what in God's name if I opened up here? Yeah. So that went on for a little while and made me realize that, yeah, you can't really do that. Not in that way.
Not in this world.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
So yeah, I got out of the way of the cop. But what this leads me to put forth, because we've had a lot of tragedies in the area. Just in the last week, we've had two people be killed in single car crashes. This very locally, they just swerved off the road and hit a tree. Two different cases. There are so many instances where people are driving. I don't know what the situation was in these cases, but I've seen many situations that almost ended like that, where people come up on you fast, or they're not signaling, or they're driving aggressively, or passing over the double yellow line. I really think we need to have more road tests. And in fact, I would say every year people should be tested on their driving skills. Now, yeah, it's a pain in the ass. It's also a great source of revenue for states and various other places that need revenue, because you certainly would have a lot of people taking these tests. But it's an important test to take because you want people who are competent on the road. And there's too many people who are incompetent. Licenses are given out to just about anybody, and they shouldn't be. They really shouldn't be. It gets less cars on the road, too, because people who fail have to keep trying until they are able to pass.
I actually I liked your idea that you mentioned. I don't know if you're remembering it verbatim, but you mentioned it in a particularly heated driving moment that everyone should have their license revoked.
Okay, yes.
And everyone should be summarily retested. So anybody who has a license now should
no
have
good
to,
anymore.
Have to go right back and get retested.
Your license is finished. It's done.
We just got to start over.
Start over. Start from scratch. Doesn't matter what country you're from. Doesn't matter your documentation. We don't care about that. We just want to make sure people know how to drive when they're on the road. That's all.
You know, light-duty truck license, just like you have commercial truck driver's licenses, if you have a car over a certain weight.
Oh, I like that.
Or
SUVs. SUVs, minivans, pickup trucks.
You need another credential on your license.
You have to be a better kind of driver. If you're driving an Uber, again, you need that chauffeur's license. I got that when I drove a limousine for a summer. I had to get a chauffeur's license. I think it was class 4 or something they called it then.
Yep.
And I don't think you really had to know anything else, but you're under more scrutiny. And there's nothing wrong with that. There is nothing wrong with people being held to a standard. The way it is now, you know, I took my road test when I was, 17 years old? I've never taken a road test since.
Yeah.
Come on, people. I mean, you're letting me loose on the highway without even checking once to see if I know what I'm doing? I mean, yeah, you checked once, but a lot has happened since then. You don't know what I'm doing now. I think people should be checked more frequently. And if you don't signal, and if you don't know how to parallel park, and if you don't know how to back up without using a camera or other electronics, then, you know, get a self-driving car because you don't know how to drive.
Yeah, I think that the real test is like driving in Manhattan when you have all of those subtle laws and little rights of way and who has a right of way, and then add in like rainy, wet streets so you're seeing the opposite reflection of all the lights, and then, you know, people in dark clothing, pedestrians, people on delivery bikes and electric bicycles and skateboards. You add all of that into the mix, plus taxis and limos and SUVs and trucks and everything. I mean, you in one, I guess, 10 or call it 20-second period, you may be hit with a bevy of decisions that you have to calculate exactly where you fit in legally with this person, that right away, and this street and that sign, let alone construction and Brownie's not paying attention, directing traffic in the wrong way. You know, who knows what it is? But I think you're right about the subtle nuances of specific scenarios, specific laws. Those are the things people forget, that like on this particular type of turn, I have to do this or I have to look here. Those little things, I think, fall by the wayside. And I think that, as you said, a lot of things have changed. And also those rules change. People add new regulations, or maybe that the things you were tested on weren't necessarily emphasized the way they are now. But add to that also the sort of media environment and smartphones, of course, the amount of distracted driving. And I think the real crescendo for me in this whole topic has been knowing people that have teenagers that are just now getting their licenses. And, you know, being like congratulatory, but at the same time, like, yeah, you know, be careful out there. Like, I'm not really entirely.
Wait, why? Because my teenager's out on the road? Is that why they're telling you to be careful?
No, like advice you'd give to a young driver starting out.
Got
and
it.
All your experience driving and what I would say, of course. And I think a lot of adults say this to younger drivers is, you know, be careful out there or drive slowly or whatever, you know, do all of those things. You can say all of that stuff, but are you really equipping them for the kind of environment, you know, driving environment that's out there, the kind of anger and aloof ignorance that is behind so many of the other wheels out there? I mean, we're essentially telling them, watch out for other drivers. Like, we're telling them the road is not safe because of drivers.
Right. Exactly.
Not them.
Yes. Yeah.
Not them being, you know, careless or not having developed a sense of consequence and so on, or their own mortality. That used to be the way we talk about it. Now it's like we're sending these, you know, teenagers who have all the distractions in the world out to be basically fresh meat on this meat grinder of a transportation system.
Yeah, but I think, you know, the problem really is the fact that the older drivers, the ones who have been on the road for a while, they're not being scrutinized nearly as much.
Yeah.
And they're getting away with all kinds of things. They're not signaling. They're driving too close. They're being intimidating, overbearing on the road, all kinds of things. I mean, there are a lot of things that seem to have just been sort of cast aside, like headlights, for instance. Now it's like you're driving into a supernova on the highway. People have these massive lights, and then you flash at them to lower the lights, and either they get really angry at you for daring to do that, or they turn on even brighter lights to indicate that those aren't my brights, those are my regular lights. Those kinds of things should not be the norm, and they have become that. Being on the road has turned into this sort of competition.
It's like Mad Max.
It really is, and a lot of people, I think, feel that way when they're on the road.
But imagine the heightened sense of awareness and what people have to rise to be able to survive that, and then all of the sort of daytime drivers that go out and are the other end of the spectrum, driving really pokey, not really paying attention, not signaling for other reasons, right? Not because they're a jerk, but because they're not really ready to be out there in this incredibly insane Mad Max kind of road warrior atmosphere. So you have that huge wide spectrum plus new drivers every year. I mean, what are we expecting is going to occur? And I agree that the headlight thing is out of control. Going from incandescent to halogen to the newer xenon headlights, as well as LED projection headlights, and now LED light bars. Yeah, all the truck bros, all the Jeep guys, you got all those cheap Chinese LED light bars, and you just love shining them because, you needed it for hunting or whatever you don't do anymore. Yeah, that's maybe legal off-road, but flashing people who are just trying to survive out there, that's unfair, and there needs to be – I mean, what kind of ticketing is going on for those kinds of lighting installations?
So here's my other idea. Instead of revoking everybody's licenses, making them take an annual road test, how about we have some software that's a part of all of our cars that basically, like many bits of software do, it judges us. It tells us if we're doing a good job. So basically, and this is not reporting back to a central server somewhere, although inevitably it probably
will. A
lot of
insurance companies have this stuff.
Well, it basically, tell me how advanced it actually is. But basically, you're doing the kinds of things we're describing now, driving down a road. Did you signal? No, didn't signal. Okay, that's something to discuss later on. Are you following too close? Are you being intimidating? Are you engaging in road rage? Are you speeding? And speeding obviously is that's a touchy issue because everyone speeds a little bit, so you don't want it to be too exact in saying yes, you did something that was wrong. I'm looking for things that are unsafe, things that could actually wind up hurting you or somebody else, such as using your phone, not looking at the road. These are the kinds of things that can be noted and can be graded, and either it just goes back to you and you do something about it, or it goes maybe to your insurance company or to the people around you to warn them that there's a dangerous driver on the road. I don't know, but we have the technology to actually address this issue rather than everybody just driving around like it's their own private highway. And everyone paying the price for that.
No, I don't want to record my driving so much. I know insurance companies are doing that, and they could be pairing that with something in the phone so that your location corresponds with different turns. Okay, yes, you should have used the signal.
No GPS, no audio. How about that? No video of inside the car. But just like things like unsafe passing or not signaling or excessive use of horn or things like that.
Yeah, I think a lot of that would be controlled through apps and from a smartphone instead of building that into some kind of specific device that reads braking and speed from the car computer, as well as recording stuff like the scenario we're in or you're in, or your eye movement or something, with a camera or some kind of machine.
Maybe you develop a relationship with your car where your car will refuse to drive with you in it if you're angry.
Yeah, this
or
is
if you just have a history of doing really bad things. It'll insist somebody else drives you, and say, okay, have your wife sit in the car and drive, and I'll go. But you, no, not going to do it.
Yeah, maybe facial recognition could tell if someone is an angry or in a heightened level of aggression, and they shouldn't be driving, and it immobilizes the vehicle. They already have this kind of thing for people who
have problems with drinking, and in the form of interlocks and breathalyzers that are installed in vehicles that an offender would want to continue to drive for work or whatever. They're required to have these kinds of devices. And I like your idea, but I can't say I would want it in, you know, one of my antique cars.
Nobody would really want it, but look, the breathalyzer thing, it's easy to get around, and it's a very simple thing. You know, you either you're drunk or you're not. And then you get to drive the car. Okay,
or
fine.
Or your grade school passenger next to you that you're taking to wherever. they're not drunk.
Well, no, but they shouldn't be driving
either. I didn't think it was that easy to defeat, though. But
well,
it's the
tried.
Same idea.
I'm not sure, but I just think, you know, I can figure out a way to defeat that. But as far as the other things, it's a bit more sophisticated. Basically, it's grading your driving skill. And maybe that just stays within the car, where the car knows this person at this hour probably is. I mean, all these other things in our homes, Nest and Ring and all the social media things, they're basically gauging us, predicting our behavior, showing us what we like, giving us the ads that appeal to us or that are relevant to our needs. How about something that actually affects our lives? Driving. You know, Harry, you have a bad history of driving at 5 a.m, especially when you're leaving a bar. The car might say, okay, I'm declining this. You know, just basically change the relationship. Make your car a little bit more intelligent, a little more caring.
But, I mean, we have a lot of surveillance out there already.
It's not surveillance because you're not reporting it to another authority. It stays between you and your car. So
That's the distinction you're making. Right, right.
Make the car, like the robot on Lost in Space, somebody that you just talk back and forth to. You can insult it if you want.
Danger.
But it has the ultimate authority in whether or not it goes. Because you know who gets hurt the most in a car crash? The car. It's the one that crashes. So there's interest in keeping it intact. That's all. So you make the car a sentient being.
All right. I'm sure it's possible. Maybe there's an app in that. So if you're looking for a graduate project or you would like to pitch this as a startup somewhere, the idea is yours.
Okay, but you can't just take the idea because it's my idea. Right? It's not your – how just give away my idea. No, it's my idea. All right? You can't just use it like that. I'm willing to discuss terms. But if this thing shows up on the market and you don't talk to me, there's going to be issues down the road. So to coin a phrase.
Yeah, the Stony Brook Law School is going to come after you. Yeah, they're on our side.
That's right. They're on our side of Nichols Road. Are we still talking about health? I went to the dentist yesterday. I went to the dentist. I had the worst dentist appointment of my life because I had to get two teeth taken care of. And one was an amputation. I had an amputation yesterday. I had a root canal in the past, and apparently there was one root left. So they had to amputate that to stop something from happening down the road. So that was a lot of fun. I'd never seen that on a receipt before, amputation. And then there was a cavity in a rather awkward place. And that was the one that really caused me the problems because I had to, like, keep my mouth open at this ridiculously weird angle. And I just kept gagging because it was unreasonable. I can't do that for 90 seconds, and people are cramming things down my throat. It's awful.
And breathing.
And I'm the one apologizing for having to stop every now and then because, you know, I'm choking. So that was a lot of fun. My tooth hurts now when it didn't before. I'm out $1,000. that is. I ask myself why? Why do I put my? Why not just let things, you know, play out? And down the road, when my teeth are falling apart, that's when I feel miserable. Not when they were feeling good. But I know that's they were responsible.
Yeah, your face will thank you later.
I hope so, because right now it's not.
It's good oral hygiene, and it's good that you're being proactive and. You'll have a lot more to work with if you take care of it sooner rather than later if you want to continue any kind of treatments. But that's my dental advice for today.
All right. Well, we've been through the ringer as far as that kind of thing goes. I haven't really paid much attention to what's going on in the world. I know something happened with Brexit today. Either it's going through or it's not going through, depending on who you listen to.
Well, there was a deal that was announced. And then I guess the government or parliament voted the deal down, or they voted no deal down?
No, they voted for the deal, but then they voted against passing the deal as quickly as Boris Johnson wanted to.
Which means he has to ask for a extension? Is that
He's got this real like point of pride where he can't ask the EU for an extension beyond October 31st.
Because then he looks like Theresa May. And
I don't know what he looks like.
He'd rather be dead in a ditch.
Actually, I do know what he looks like. But he basically sent a letter, as he is required to by law, asking them for an extension. But he didn't sign the letter because he's a baby. Instead, he wrote a second letter that he did sign saying it would be a mistake to grant what was asked for in the first letter that he didn't sign. These are the children that are running governments these days. So I don't know what the EU is doing tonight. They're scratching their heads. Why did we ever let the UK in the first place, you know? But here's my prediction. So if this actually does go through, and it could, I think you're going to see Scotland become independent down the road. I keep saying down the road. Eventually.
Down the trail.
I think you'll see unification in Ireland. In other words, the UK is going to shrink a little bit. It's going to be England and Wales. And they might not hold on to Wales either.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens. It's interesting. In this country, what's going on in this country? Impeachment barreling down the road?
Well, there's been a bunch of testimony behind closed doors and a full court press, I think, from the Republican side. Basically, all of the lapdogs for Trump are coming out and saying, like, you know, this is impeachment inquiry has no credibility. They're calling for they tried to censure Adam Schiff. That did not go well yesterday, which it is, in and of itself, it was absurd for them to do this. And they're contending that this whole thing is a kangaroo court. That word's been thrown around a whole bunch. But they're impugning the inquiry of a body of government that has every right to inquire about these things, especially given the context from the whistleblower complaint, specifically around arms deals and so on with Ukraine. So they're trying to downplay this whole thing as the Democrats host a bipartisan, closed-door, secure testimony from various witnesses that they've called. And among those have been like the top U.S. ambassador. That was today. Top U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. That was today. And other such career officials from the State Department and our sort of diplomatic arm. And there's this kind of question about, well, or what the I think Republicans want is that we're trying to split hairs over whether this was a corruption investigation that was asked for in general, or whether it was specifically about finding corrupt Democrats, which is not a really objective way to go about rooting out corruption. That's a very specific political bent under the guise of a corruption investigation. And that's kind of where we're at.
Wow. It's interesting to see the tactics that are being used by the Republicans. Basically, Trump is being accused of being corrupt and doing illegal things. And they turn around and they just make the same accusations about Democrats. Again, it's that childishness where, you know, censoring Schiff is insane because he's doing what he's supposed to do. He's investigating this. It's a closed investigation. Our own representative here, Lee Zeldin, is constantly complaining that it's not being made public, but it's a closed-door investigation. That's how investigations work. And for some reason, he's involved in that as well. I guess he's on the committee. But every day, like clockwork, he says, there's nothing in there, no investigation. There's no evidence of guilt. And it's worse than having Trump in your backyard, I swear. When the information comes out, it's pretty damning. When we hear what's being said, like the opening statement today for that ambassador.
Yeah.
Wow. It basically is, if you didn't have the evidence on you already as far as the quid pro quo that Trump was engaged in, here it is again. You know, more evidence that that is exactly what was going on regarding Ukraine.
He basically said he wanted Zelensky to be in a political box. And what that means is he wanted a public statement about this corruption inquiry that Giuliani was pushing, and specifically about the Bidens and what's it called? Bessemer, Ross, some gas company, whatever it's called. But that in and of it, that is the
the sort of impetus for going forward here, that they were alarmed by the requests to pursue this specifically as a linchpin to other foreign policy initiatives, right? Kind of lost. That's all. Okay. I just lost what I was saying. I was a little distracted. Well, you look very busy over there.
Well, I was looking at up things, and as soon as you said Lynch, I looked up.
The, oh, no. Did I?
Yeah. Well, so did Trump. He said that what was going on with him is basically a modern-day lynching. As if, you know, you haven't already offended half the world or most of the world. He goes and says something like this. And then, you know, Lindsey Graham doubles down on it and defends him and says, yeah, it's lynching in every sense of the word. He literally said that. In every sense of the word. Do you know what that means? You're from South Carolina. You should know what that means. To say that, to use a word like that and then to double down and say, oh, yes, that's accurate in every sense of the word. I mean, you know, in Chile, there are people rioting in the streets because of a transit fare hike. In Hong Kong, people are rioting in the streets because of the specter of China taking over and making their lives miserable and things not being optimum for them right now. In Lebanon, there are demonstrations. Here, what's going on? What are we waiting for here?
Halloween.
Well, it's coming. It's coming up. So
Christmas.
Get your gear together because
Prime Day.
You have to at some point do something, and just waiting around and letting people say dumber and dumber things every single day, that's not enough. That's not doing it. So, you know, when you have somebody use words like that and then double down and defend it, I don't know. It just seems like you have to react at some point.
I can't remember what exactly that cover statement was. That's what I lost really what I was saying, because I was trying to paraphrase the exact crux of what he was saying. I got that a little bit confused. So, but indeed, it is. It's something interesting that in the conversation we were pointing, you were pointing out that we feel often like there are not enough people that are upset about these things. Kind of like what you're saying. Where is the action as a response? And people often don't want to be the guy. They don't want to stick their neck out. They want to just play it safe. They want to, you know, as long as the mass genocide doesn't really, you know, go over the fence onto my yard or in my lawn, I'm okay. That, you know, as long as it's not bothering me, it's not. I mean, we're losing a sense of loyalty to our fellow citizens that I think is dangerous. And it makes it seem as though there really isn't as much upset from individuals. And that powerlessness, I think, is something that we can all combat in whatever actions and power in your at the community level that you have. But it is pretty amazing that adults are kind of leading by example and being as or almost more apathetic than the sort of generations that we feel are looking up to us. So we should lead by a better example. If not, we may have surprises like they have in Hong Kong, where the youth surprise the older generation who are just getting by and being safe and don't want to be bothered. And, is, you know, as long as I have rice in my bowl or whatever, you know, the metaphor is that they, you know, won't make any waves for anyone. And the youth is like, no, I've been looking for a job for 10 years, you know, or I've been sticking my neck out and you're now ruining my future possibilities, or you're not fighting and inaction is going to basically hand my future to Beijing, or in the case of any kind of climate action, you know, we could go on and on about toxicity and environment and then the parallels there, or abuse of individuals and segments of communities within our countries. But the crux of it is that, you know, if you're mad and you're asking around and you're kind of feeling like, no, there's not really much going on action wise. Mm-hmm. There's so many things people can do, and a lot of it is creative. Some of it's politically inspired, but I think having the conversation and motivating and lead by action, that's really what I think is missing, because anything else leaves people, I think, underwhelmed and feeling as though if they do anything, they won't be safe. And that's not true. We have strength in numbers, and that's I think what's forgotten.
Well, in this country, I think we have a lot of faith in the system. Something that's not true in other places. So we all think, you know, the election will solve everything. And maybe that's true. Maybe we should have faith in the system. But I also think it's important to express yourself between elections and to let those politicians, let those same ones know you're out there so that maybe they adjust their tune a little bit. Maybe they're not so blind in their allegiance to their supposed leader or leaders. And maybe they start representing the people they're supposed to represent. You got to make yourself visible. You got to make yourself loud. It does work. I mean, like I said, in Chile, it was a transit fare hike. That's what did it. Now, as long as we're comfortable in one way or another, maybe that's how you quell the mobs, by making sure everybody has their Netflix and their latest cell phone and video games and things like that. And you tell them the unemployment rate is low, even though nobody can afford to buy a house. And maybe that's how you keep the crowds off the street. But it just takes one thing too much for people to handle. And then it spills out because, you know, Hong Kong started as one thing. Chile started as one thing. It turns into more things. It doesn't matter after a while when the government starts to give concessions because the people want more. And they realize they have this kind of power, so they demand more, and it just gets louder and louder. I don't know if I want that in this country, but I think we need to realize that we do have that power should we choose to exercise it.
Yeah, and it ebbs and flows. I mean, we saw anti-corruption schemes take one direction and go well in Brazil, like the Petrobras bus, the car wash, Operation Car Wash, and all of those things. But then, of course, their administration went very populist and went, you know, right back into a lot of what is kind of in vogue around the world. But we could easily, you know, be talking about local representatives standing up to the idiocy and the disintegration of constitutional and other authority that both, you know, the House, both the Congress and the Senate have, like, as far as oversight and these inquiries go. But I think that the local representation is terrified of the base more than being welcomed or applauded by the opposition or their perceived opposition. You know what I'm saying?
Well, if you talk about the local representation, it means Zeldin. I think he's more terrified of Trump than of the base.
Exactly. If he's on the other end of Trump's ire, he knows that all of Trump's base, all those urchins out here, lovely Suffolk County and other citizens, they will turn their ire to him, and he won't be able to persist doing what? I don't know. I'm sure he's great for this community, but I think there's a miscalculation in that.
Yeah, and it has to be brought home.
And this is where bipartisanship, standing up for a greater or higher calling as far as, you know, the Constitution goes, as far as, you know, what it means to be a public servant and who you're actually serving.
Good point. Hey, I just got this terrible story. I want to read this before we go into our next segment. This is about a British man who killed himself rather than enduring more tooth pain. Yeah.
Excuse me?
That's what happened. I can sort of understand. He couldn't handle the – well, first of all, this story is just written in such a terrible way. He couldn't handle the tooth. Yeah, Englishman Anthony Hoskins took his own life rather than dealing with painful toothaches that were a few weeks away from being fixed. That's according to The Mirror. They're responsible for the tone of this article. The 38-year-old man reportedly endured dental agony for more than 9 months with the help of whiskey and painkillers, but he'd had enough of the pain. That's according to his mom. She needed nearly $2,000 to have her son's wisdom teeth removed and was more than halfway there, the report said. And a law enforcement inquiry into the man's death on April 3rd, I don't know why we're hearing about it now, revealed he was on a waiting list for public health care but wanted to expedite the procedure. The victim's mom said her son had no financial problems, but The Mirror claimed a bank receipt showed a recent overdraft of almost $4,000 to his account. It's also unclear why his mom was saving for the employment agency workers' dental care, but that's another issue. Anthony is at rest now, will not suffer any more pain, his mother said. But she also told the Mirror that his funeral services wound up costing her as much as a tooth extraction would have. That is what truly makes this an awful story.
Wait, wow. So this is just like the bottom line story is you know, either way, he was nice to have around, but, you know, we solved that.
Yeah, and, his mom has an attitude, I think, about
it worked
this.
Out on paper, so we're happy.
Well, no,
he's in a good place now.
Well, he's not in any more pain, but she still had to spend the money. That's what I'm getting out of this.
I will say, wisdom teeth at 38, those are some big teeth by then. I mean, I had all of mine removed when I was very young, and they're monsters. I mean, they're way back there, and I could see it being really exceedingly uncomfortable.
The point is, don't deal with pain. Don't get addicted to things. You're entitled to health care, and in England especially, you should be able to get this done. So I hope people out there, when something is bothering them, they don't wait. They go and get it checked, and they get it taken care of, and not worry about the expense, because you have the right. And they hold it over your head, let them do that, but don't let it make your health any worse.
Yeah, I mean, come on, we're separating twins joined at the head. You can get some teeth out.
Uh-huh. Those twins aren't paying for
this.
This
is not that complicated. I don't know why it has to be such a struggle for everyone, but yet it is.
And it's time once again.
Are we going to have room for that?
We're going to try. It's for film forum. Fest. You know, we got to name this feature.
Film a week.
Film, no, it's not. It's more than one sometimes.
Hold on, it's a little dusty.
All right, dust that off. Yes, this is where we look at a film in the history of the world. We're moving through the Academy Award winning pictures of the years. Started in 1929. Actually, started in the 1800s, but there wasn't an Academy Award then. But now we're up to 1960, and we just saw a couple of really interesting films.
Yes.
The Apartment with
Jack Lemmon.
Jack Lemmon. Wow, a young Jack Lemmon.
Shirley MacLaine.
And Fred McMurray from My Three Sons, playing a real ripe bastard.
Oh, gosh. I really liked it. It was, you pointed out early on in the film, it was a little bit of kind of a consumer angle, and it had a bit of a dystopian feel, as we've mentioned before. A little bit of a commentary on the times, the working stiff and New York office pools of just typewriters and calculators.
They had this set where it must have been 500 people on the set, just desks and desks and desks going all the way back. And what I heard was they used full-size people in the front, they used smaller people in the back or children, and then they used mannequins way in the back and they just moved them around. That's how they created that.
That very wide shot, it reminded me of a lot of the commercial photography from Andreas Gursky. You can look him up, and has done a lot of really incredible work with pattern and huge scale, just enormous buildings and repetition and pattern like that. And it just that one shot of the office that sets that is just so emblematic of it, and it just makes it just lends more to this guy climbing the ladder that he's just so far from really ever making it. But
it reminded me of Brazil, actually.
Absolutely.
That's not the first film to remind me of that, but this is this kind of faceless bureaucracy that you're a part of.
Yeah, and so the premise is he's a guy just working in a department at an insurance company.
It's called an insurance company.
Guaranteed Indemnity or something.
Something like that, yeah.
Something really generic. But anyway, the premise is that he's working there, and as a part of his job, and he has an apartment, right? It's his refuge after work. But of course, he can't go because there's these things going on. Essentially, he's lending keys so that other coworkers and senior partners at this insurance company can come by with their mistresses.
Yes.
So he's sort of running a little bit of a brothel sort of, but not really. It's just the married upper echelons of his insurance company need a spot to crash in. So he's basically got a schedule. And in the beginning, he's going through his Rolodex and he's going through his calendar. He's got this place booked weeks in advance just for all of the let's say, extracurricular, extramarital affairs going on within this insurance company.
Yeah, now this was an interesting film because it kind of didn't punish immoral behavior. Now, the production code was something that was in force in the United States for a good part of the 20th century, and it started to become less and less enforced in motion pictures around this period. I think it finally stopped altogether in 1968. But basically what it meant was that if you had somebody engaging in immoral contact, such as having an affair, you know, having sex without being married or killing somebody, they had to be punished for it somehow. You couldn't end the film and not have them get their comeuppance. That doesn't happen in this film. I mean, they're not glorified, but they're still continuing doing what they're doing. They're still the same people that they were. They don't get this revelation that, oh, they should have done something different.
And in fact, it shows how it is integrated into that hierarchy, that hierarchical structure, mm-hmm. that he's forced, you know, his livelihood depends on showing up for work. And of course, they show how it disrupts his own well-being. He becomes sick. He becomes he can't sleep. He becomes totally out of sorts, and he thus can't fulfill his job obligations even while he's there because he has no place of refuge. And it's just fascinating how that hierarchical structure reinforces him accepting the the sort of amoral activities of those higher ups. But it is all. It's all part of the game, and I think that's kind of interesting how it shows those structures reinforcing what would be maybe considered amoral or otherwise run afoul of the code. And of course, they don't show it, but as you said, they don't show the story arc as having been resolved appropriately. They just let it flat, land flat as it is,
right,
to just present that this is business. This is the corporate world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's the epitome of a rat race. I mean,
it's interesting too, because it's the kind of film, you're not sure if it's a comedy or a commentary on the social structure. Fred McMurray had a hard time because, as I said, he was in My Three Sons, had this, you know, this wholesome image. This film did not present him that way. Some of his fans were very, very angry that, he had that kind of a role. In fact, one woman hit him with a purse, I understood. There was this one actress, too. She played the blonde in the bar. I think Joyce Jameson was her name. She basically lived on the Upper West Side. She told this story in one of the extras on the Blu-ray about how she basically went out to get food somewhere at a grocery store and was walking down West 69th Street and saw these people taking pictures of her building, asked what they were doing, and they told her they were making a movie there. She went home, told her mother. Her mother said, you know, you should get back into acting, because she had been in Hollywood before that. And she was convinced to, yeah, go out there, give it another shot. She went out, got an agent, and read for a film that turned out to be the very film that she saw them taking pictures for on that street near her house. So that was kind of a weird story right there.
Wow. So it was like they were doing pre-production stuff?
Yeah, they were just basically scoping it out.
Yeah, yeah, sighting. And
they even flew her all the way back to New York to film that scene on that street. And then they decided, you know what, this will look better on a soundstage. So they flew her back to California and filmed the same scene on a pre-made set of that street.
I think that's called location scouting.
It's called Hollywood is what it's called.
Location survey.
We anything more on that film? Because we have the foreign film.
There's plenty to say. It is very well shot. It was black and white. That's worth pointing out. Mm-hmm. And you're right. It was mentioned in some of the analysis of it that it was both dark and dramatic and serious and also comedic. There's some slapstick stuff, some just funny situational stuff in it. And really interesting shots of New York and I don't know.
Yeah. It's always good to see New York in decades past. So the foreign film that won the Academy Award for 1960 was The Virgin Spring by
yes.
Ingmar Bergman.
Yes.
And wow, this was something else. Boy, you know, films in foreign countries and films in the United States are just different species. This was something that could never be shown on U.S. screens back then, certainly, maybe even today. Concerned the story of, I understood it was 14th century Sweden this family who ran a farm, had various farm hands, and I believe two daughters. One daughter was a half sister to the other one. I'm not exactly sure what the family dynamics were, but the upshot was that the daughter that was pure, the virgin, her job was to bring, what was it, flowers?
Candles
to a church many miles away, mm-hmm. because she was a virgin.
Yes.
That's how it works. And she was riding a horse, and the half-sister went with her. Now, the half-sister, okay, you have all these religious things going on, too. You've got Catholicism, and you've got paganism.
Yes.
And the half-sister cast some kind of pagan curse on her. Mm-hmm. Because she was jealous. The half-sister was pregnant, and the virgin, well, obviously was not, and was favored in the household and seemed to be – everything was going well. Well, on this voyage, things did not go so well for the virgin. She was, in fact, attacked and raped in a brutal scene that I cannot believe was from 1960. So that happened. And then after all that, fast forward back to the farm where people are wondering where the daughter is. And we, of course, know her fate. We know that she was murdered. The very people who did this, actually three brothers, one of whom is only a child, didn't participate, but, you know, was part of the three and was kind of just a witness. They come upon this farmhouse, not knowing it's the same farmhouse that that girl came from. And are asking for a shelter, for work, whatever. And then they make the mistake of offering for sale these garments that they actually stole from the girl. So the parents obviously recognize those garments. And
they were unique and beautiful.
Very
and,
unique. There's a lot of time spent on them,
yeah.
in the beginning of the film.
Yep.
And so that while the three are sleeping, they plot their revenge.
Oh, indeed, absolutely. They lock them in, and among other things, they seek and find their retribution, and then they go and see for themselves this horrific crime scene and so on. And,
well, I mean, we can give spoilers. Spoiler alerts for all the people that intend on seeing 1960 films after tonight. They kill them all. They kill the kid. You can't do that in American films. They take this little kid and they just throw him against, well, the father does this. He throws him against the wall, kills him instantly. The kid had nothing to do with it. The kid was pretty innocent, actually. In fact, he was.
They didn't know that the kid didn't have anything to do with it. He was kind of lumped in.
He was eight. I mean, come on. What could he have done? He was getting sick all the time because he was so racked with guilt at what his two brothers had done.
That's what it was.
I think that's what it was.
And there was other moments when you thought he had been hit or he was bleeding and you thought he was, like, injured. But, yeah, he was sort of a casualty of this group of brothers.
Well, his brothers were beating him up, I think, because he was not accepting what they were doing to other people.
And he might squeal. And so on.
Maybe. Yeah. So all three of them get killed, and it's a really horrendous scene. But then, as you said, yes, they go out to see where the daughter was left. And the film ends. And this is something, actually, I found out Ingmar Bergman did not like this ending. He thought it was a bit too in your face, where you lift up the daughter, and all of a sudden, this spring of water comes from the ground. That's the virgin spring. It's not the season. It's the water. And it's kind of like this big religious statement that he wasn't really into. But it's kind of neat, I guess. And then he pledges to build a church on that very site, and that's your film there.
Give me. Sorry. I don't want to editorialize too much, but yeah, the I don't know, the showing of this spot as now being a place of this spring. I mean, it's very mystical and miraculous, but it's still a Swedish rape and revenge film.
That is pretty much it, literally. But that's going to have to do it for us here tonight because we're out of time. We could do a whole hour on these.
And building churches doesn't fix everything. I mean, come on.
We know from experience.
How about
yes.
Truth and Reconciliation? How about some other religious buildings? You know, a mosque. Why not?
Yeah,
synagogue.
Uh huh. Or yeah. Just a simple shed.
Yeah,
that's all people need.
Sweat lodge.
We can build all kinds of things.
Okay.
But we'll have to build them elsewhere because we're out of time. Finn is coming up next. You can write to us, otw@2600.com is our email address. We always love to read your cards and letters. Not that anyone sends us cards by email, but send us things. We definitely are in need of people communicating.
We will spend your gift cards.
If you send those.
If you send us those, I don't know why you would. We're going to have all kinds of fun things ahead, as you will find on this radio station, which, by the way, we're in radiothon mode. So if you want to pledge to this radio station, please do. WUSB.FM. It's a great place. It doesn't get taken over by crazy people who force everybody out into the street, like certain radio stations do.
Yeah, and we're giving waves as a thank you gift. You get one entire wave of the 90.1 frequency.
Okay, you got to talk to Kyle about that, but there's all kinds of cool premiums that you really can get.
I'm kidding.
Yeah. Again, WUSB.FM is our website, and we have all kinds of information there.
Lots of swag, new sweatshirts, new tote bags, the whole nine. But the real gift is the station, is the community, and of course, on some level, us, this fabulous off-the-wall radio program.
And all the other radio programs that appear. You can join the 90.1 Club, pledging $90.10, because 90.1 is our frequency. You can join the 107.3 Club, because 107.3 is our other frequency, $107.30. And you get all kinds of cool things when you do that.
There's also a $35 pick two items level. There's a pick three items level for $65. So lots of different variations on the theme here for
Radiothon.
You could
pay $5 a month, and that turns into $60 a year, which is awesome. All kinds of ways to do this. All the details at WUSB.FM.
Find something that works for you.
And we'll see you next week. Good night.